And we are recording.
All right. Okay. We're live.
We are live.
Live,
we are live
recorded.
Mm-hmm. So welcome, Nick. This is my buddy, Nick Fuller. I believe this is going to be a cross-posted episode. So this is going to be on Mutations and our brand new co-hosted podcast, Technologisms, which already has one back episode. If you go check it out, we're doing a review of Stranger Things and Vaporwave, Stranger Things season 3. Really fun episode, had a lot of fun editing it, and I think it summed up a lot of the themes that we're going to be exploring in this new podcast together. So welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, yeah, as we said, we wanted to get this up fairly quickly with minimal editing because The Matrix, what was it? You just saw this in theaters at AMC at Disney Springs. I should add this too. The both of us are located in Florida on opposite coasts. So I'm in the Tampa Bay area and you are in the Space Coast area. And you recently went to Disney Springs because Florida is all about Disney and watched The Matrix, which was, I think, digitally remastered or something to that extent, right?
Yeah. I forget the exact credentials for what they did to the mastery on this re-release, but it's the 20th anniversary re-release of The Matrix, and just about a week or so before that occurred, they announced that at least one of the Wachowski siblings, who were, of course, the directors and writers for The Matrix series, is returning and bringing Carrie-Anne Moss, who played Trinity, and Keanu Reeves, who played Neo, back for a sequel. That's really all we know. So that's pretty exciting for a lot of reasons. For those that don't know or don't remember, Ken Wilber, I believe, did audio commentary about The Matrix on one of the DVD sets. And that was I remember one of the earliest, whoa, this Ken Wilber guy's huge. He's commenting on The Matrix, you know? And that was, when you and I were young, was a really big deal. But just in general, I would say that probably for an entire generation of filmmakers, video game makers, writers, and just creative people in general, The Matrix probably had a pretty significant effect on you in a lot of ways, because it was the first movie to do what it was doing. And the best way I could describe what it did was it had a secret, and it didn't tell you what the secret was going to be until you watched the movie. And these days, especially post M. Night Shyamalan, the idea of a movie having something in it that you just don't know about is pretty significant or pretty insignificant, because it happens fairly regularly. You know, M. Night Shyamalan having a movie that has a twist in it. It happens. A lot of horror movies these days have big twists in it, and then you'll even hear it as part of. Oh, shut up, buddy. And you'll even hear about it as part of the actual the commentary on it is you'll hear people say, oh, with a twist that you'll never see coming. You know, you hear that about movies these days. But at least for our generation, what The Matrix managed to put together was something that was basically going, hey, there is this way that you can look at the world. And it's your world, your real world, as you know it, as you think about it, as you manage it, as you understand it. And we're going to show you that there is this whole other secret world beneath it. And I feel like a lot of, that trope of our world specifically, but then something underneath is kind of underutilized. Usually you have somebody else whose ordinary world, let's say, or ordinary life isn't really like our real life. Whereas, in 1999, a great example is the character of Neo. He starts out the movie as a programmer. He's just a coder. He's a coder working in a business suit in a cubicle. And in, 1999, that had a particular kind of look and a vibe to it. And today, with more people coding, more people working at computers, more people working in cubicles probably than ever, I feel like that aesthetic in that sort of ordinary world is even more accessible than it was then, because, at least at the time it was oh, you're on the cutting edge of technology. And while that's definitely still happening today with people that are coding and, spending their time in cubicles doing that sort of coding, programming kind of work, I think that there's a little bit of demystification of that today, but I think that actually helps the sort of the journey for Neo in the Matrix, because we can take it more, we can more easily take it with us, because even if you've never coded, if you're not a hacker like Neo is, you can understand working in a cubicle in a big high rise, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is all pre 9/11 too. So, the bad guys aren't terrorists, you know? And it's kind of interesting though, because there is mentions in the movies of Morpheus being referred to as a terrorist by sort of the FBI, you know, and people looking for him as he's a known terrorist, you know, which in 1999 had a very different sort of connotation to it than it did post 9/11, you know?
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, sort of to make a long rant short, me, my wife, and my stepson, who's 15, we brought our nephew to go see the movie remastered. And it was fantastic seeing it again. I've seen it dozens of times. Maybe hundreds of times in my life. There was a time in high school where I literally put the entire trilogy one after the other and always kept them looping on my TV whenever I wasn't using it to play video games. It was just like, I was just constantly obsessed with just seeing the Matrix, thinking about the Matrix, and, you know, and of course, escapism. Right. You know, I mean, like, you know, as a teenager, no matter what kind of upbringing you have, there's some angst, there's some not feeling like you fit in. So the whole idea of the Matrix itself as being something that's present and you're kind of aware of it and it's kind of messing mm-hmm. with you, but you can't see it, you can't affect it, and you can't learn anything about it, and you can't do anything about it, sort of resonates in a lot of ways to every teenager. You know, this idea totally. That like life itself is this weird thing that is just, it's a system of rules and we don't really understand it. And it's just all this, you know, hundreds or even thousands of years of precedence that makes these rules, and we just have to deal, you know,
it's the perfect coming of age story, the hero's journey for the teenager coming of age in the age of computers. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. I was just thinking of this as you're talking about it, but really, you know, for our generation, we were both born in 1987. Right. And, grew up through the 90s, as much as Star Wars was influential for us as this modern mythology, in many ways, the Matrix. And by that, I don't mean the whole trilogy. I don't know how well, the other movies really did to really create this mythos, but the first Matrix movie was kind of our generation's Star Wars mm-hmm. in that, like, it set up the mythos for the age that we lived in, the age of computers and the internet and code. And okay, the code and computers as a metaphor for reality, right? As, you know, the hacker is somebody who can warp and bend the spoon, right? Because mm-hmm. there is no spoon. It's just information. There's just so many fun things in this movie that just stand in for, it's just the image of the world, right? We live in a computer world of digital technology. We grew up in it. And here is a fantastic story that extends the metaphor of the computer and says, like, hey, what if the entire, and this might be one of the first films that really does this in mass media, this new mythos, which is very popular today, by the way, the holographic universe hypothesis, yeah, sure. that we live inside of a computer program. And here is a 1999 movie that does that. And it sort of sets the tone for the whole internet age, right? Like, to me, it's just the myth of the computer age and the internet age is this right. sort of hero's journey using the computer rather than, you know, Star Wars and space stories and space wizards as the metaphor. No, in this one, it's like the rabbit hole and Neo and initiation and having to kind of die and be reborn. I mean, gosh, there's just so many archetypal themes in this film that work yeah. so well and translate so well into images of modern technology, right? Modern technology mythologized into something more. And that's what I love about it. I just watched it too. Like, you went and saw it at Disney Springs, and I watched it at home by myself with a glass of wine and a notepad. But I thoroughly enjoyed myself as well, because it's been a long time since I've seen it.
Well, like, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about watching it again and kind of seeing things in a somewhat new way, because I was, you know, every year you become a different person. Every year you change a little bit, you reflect back a little bit. And I think one of the things that was pretty interesting was that a lot of the script and the actual dialogue between characters is just so tight. There's not a single shot that overstays its welcome. There's not a single scene I can think of that can just be excised or stays its length. And I don't just say that as a fan. I mean, literally watching it, I was like, that sentence that they just said is incredibly important to the plot. And that sentence that they said is just important to that character extremely, you know? And there was just so many times where I was just kind of blown away. I was like, wow, it's just so well put together, and there's so little sort of fat on it, that it's just so lean. It's telling its story so quickly, and it's telling such a broad story so fast that it's amazing that they were able to get so much dense information into such a short period of time. Like, even
especially the Wachowskis, right? I mean, they're infamous for being very Baroque with like very top heavy intellectual films that want to say a lot and end up saying a lot through the character dialogue.
Yeah.
But you're right. This first film is just so lean. Every single sentence is deliberate, and there's a kind of a brilliant minimalism in it. It gets the message across without saying too much, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it relies mostly on the structure of the story to help amplify the meaning. And there's all these great little hints and codes in it too. Like, I think he's got like a book where he's got his like hacker thing that he's selling Neo at the beginning of the film, right? And he flips mm-hmm. open Simulacra,
yeah,
which is based off of, I think it's riffing off of Baudrillard's book, a real life book. And I've heard this too, that the Wachowskis forced all of the actors to read that book before starting on the set. So they really wanted to get the message across, not only to the audience, but seemingly to the actors, to really kind of get what they were doing there. And I find that to be really interesting. You know, we might have to do a follow-up episode too after listening to the Wilbur and Cornel West commentary. Because there's an audio commentary on most of the DVD sets, and now, of course, I think any kind of digital version you can download has this audio track you can add with commentary, and it's Ken Wilbur and Cornel West, which, oh my gosh, like, who would have thought of those two coming together? But they do so really, really well. From what I remember, it was a very interesting conversation, and they both have
been
very
a long time
complimentary takes. Yeah, yeah.
Like, so one of the things that I find kind of interesting about some of the sort of aesthetic choices about different aspects of things, like, one of the things is that, you know, so one of the things is like tech bros, right? So tech bros are basically like the new way of sort of viewing Silicon Valley hacker culture, right? In a lot of ways. And a lot of ways people think of like tech bros as being, you know, dudes with glasses who are kind of like libertarian or libertarian leaning, you know, while also maybe mm-hmm. being very socially liberal as well, potentially. Sometimes not. But it's kind of interesting seeing the 1999 version of the non-tech bro aesthetic, you know? Like, so one of the things is, you know, Neo is pretty clearly a shut-in and doesn't get out much in general. So not just an introvert, but not very good at social things at all. So I actually really liked that aspect of it, because it felt like a more real character. It felt more real, really representative of the introverted technology people that I know and I speak with the majority of my time with, you know, across all the different games that I've played, across all the different conventions that I've gone to, and, you know, from VR stuff to just regular video games. I find that more often than not, there's just this slight awkwardness that makes a nerd in a lot of ways, you know, like in this particular way. Like, we see Neo, he isn't going to go to a club. He doesn't want to. He has no interest. You can tell that a club has never given him anything that he liked out of the experience. So when his, I don't know if it's a friend or if it's a colleague or if it's just a person who is just looking to, you know, get whatever disc or whatever it is that Neo's providing early on, he's invited out, and he's basically like, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, like, why? I'm just going to stay in. And the dude is like, oh, you look paler than usual, which in this particular scene, the way that they filmed Keanu Reeves, he looked incredibly pale, especially with the four or five people that are at his door who are not at all that same kind of shade of pale. And so it's, of course, a joke that he, you know, doesn't get out much. And then even within the world of not getting out much, he really doesn't get out much. And of course, one of the first things that we see of Neo is he's laying there with his headphones on, sleeping on his desk with books and all kinds of, I don't know if it's garbage, but just sort of things strewn about, this idea that he might not even need his bed half the time. So this guy is living in his computer, you know? And at the time, I remember in the 90s, like, I remember there being things in the news that was like, kids these days are starting to live entirely online on their computers. What are your kids doing? Stuff like that, right? So, like, one of the interesting things about The Matrix is that it was showing something that only a few people were like back then in 1999, but more people are like, and more people understand, even if they are not like it today, you know, because I mean, really between the release of The Matrix and the smartphone revolution, everybody became sort of technologically minded. You know?
Oh yeah, everybody lives online. I mean, that's exactly what we do as moderns. Is like, we check our phone when we wake up and when we're going to sleep, and maybe in the middle of the night when we can't sleep. I mean, we're Neo with our head down on the keyboard. You know,
yeah,
that's just our reality.
We literally fall asleep with our phones in our hands, with our computers in our hands. We just don't think of it that way.
I do that with my Kindle. It's a Paperwhite, so it's not so bad with the eye damage or anything. But I like to read until I start to pass out at night, you know, just read a good fiction book. And that's just what I do. But I realize that, like, yeah, I'm totally soothed and surrounded and cocooned by the digital environment, which sounds very much like The Matrix, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And, you know, and so what's kind of great about the feeling of it is that it basically says that he's living in the computer while he's living in a computer, right? So he's spending his life in the Matrix, because everybody is. But then within that life of the Matrix, he's also within a sort of matrix of his own making, if that makes sense, you know, the internet matrix, let's say, you know. So he's sort of already two layers deep in certain ways when we meet him as, you know, as a character. And of course, that's kind of, I feel like in a lot of ways, that's kind of what the internet does to you, right? I mean, right now people talk about, you know, disconnecting. Right. And you got to turn your phone off. You got to turn off alerts. You got to get away from social media and things like that. Right. And, you know, there's a statement specifically made to Neo that's like, dude, you got to unplug. Right. And so kind of in certain ways, it was this idea of, you know, meat space needing, having some sort of a greater, grander thing there. If you just, you know, if you can just unplug, you'll get better perspective, or you'll feel more well or something, right? So they sort of had this idea even back then that, you know, there's sort of a wellness that can kind of degrade potentially depending on how you're interacting with your technology, you know, and in your online digital life. And I think that today we take that sort of for granted, that everyone's already hooked and addicted and needs to disconnect, you know? Like, I think pretty much everybody has this idea of like screen time. Right. Whether they're using too much of it or not too much of it, everybody pretty much understands that, like, oh, I'm really stuck to the things I'm stuck to. You know, like there are many people who literally can't ever have their phone on silent because they might be getting important phone calls, because they're either on call or they are effectively on call because they are a salaried person in a salaried position, and they are essentially required to answer emails literally 24/7. You know, for people like that, that can't even go on vacation, you know, without actually having to continue to stay connected, this idea of disconnecting is sort of majestic, right? And and looking at what The Matrix does, you know, you take the red pill and you get disconnected, right? And wouldn't it be great if we could just take a pill and we were just disconnected, right?
And well, that's like the allure of this film is very mythical in that sense. It's like, it's taking the metaphor of reality that we now take for granted in the 21st century, but was still kind of coming online in the, literally, no pun intended, in the 20th century, which is computers and computer programs and operating systems and the virtual spaces. And it takes that as a metaphor for our world and says, like, what if the world you're living in. It's just a simulation. It's just a computer program. And you are this free agent or potentially free agent. You've had the wool pulled over your eyes and you don't realize that you're self-enslaved, right? You're hooked up to the system. You're jacked in. It's a Plato's cave scenario where like you're down in the cave and there's shadows on the wall that you mistake to be reality, and there's a way out, right? And this is your initiation into this greater reality. You could just slip out of this, and then somehow you can hack it too, right? You can mm-hmm. mess with it. You can go back in as this free agent with this new level of like getting it, and that you can in some way kind of fight the people who've developed the system of control. And like Morpheus brings that up the whole time too. This is like the Gnostic myth. This is the kind of, you know, fight the system kind of mythos that is so attractive to teenagers mm-hmm. and just anybody with that kind of, you know, anti-authoritarian attitude and value. It's like, it's all about control. It's all about control and understanding control and fighting control. You know, they say it at the end, they say it at the beginning. Morpheus mm-hmm. says it, and then Agent Smith says it. And then like on top of it, right, on top of all that is this kind of Gnostic myth. And a lot of like religious studies scholars have looked at this film too, because of the Gnosticism that's involved, that like you are ensnared in an illusion set up by very deliberately by other beings that are using it to get something out of you, and that you need to awaken and get out of it and somehow kind of transcend it. But on the other hand, it's also, it kind of flips back and forth, because if you remember at the end of the film, Agent Smith is very disgusted by being in the Matrix as well. Mm-hmm. He's very Gnostic. He wants to get the hell out. He hates, and he talks about it in such a guttural embodied way. He it's filthy. He hates the smell of humans. You know, the way he talks about it is this like physical disgust at being an embodied creature in this Matrix. And he just wants out. He wants to be free of it. And this also is a Gnostic theme as well. I mean, some Gnostic communities, even in ancient times, would be very, you know, part of their rules would be like, you can't procreate. You don't want to bring anybody in here. You know, everybody's got to get out.
Right.
You don't want to do anything carnal and physical. You want to eat as minimally as possible. You want to only have like vegetables and eat vegetarian and not harm other beings. It's like, it's a very kind of transcendental oriented mythology. So this film also captures that. And I think it again, like, renders something very classical from antiquity into something very modern. With the metaphor of technology and the computer to do it. It's really brilliant in that way, you know?
Yeah, especially because, you know, at the time, you know, like I said, while definitely a growing population of the world was more technologically, you know, minded and was, you know, embodying and embracing technology more and more, that just continued exponentially since the movie came out, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, you and I have talked about the smartphone revolution, how just absolutely just game changing that was for our culture. But I also think that it could be said that people themselves have sort of changed as well. So we want, like you mentioned, like cocooning, like we sort of want that, right? Like we sort of want the technology to envelop us. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, when it doesn't, you get a lot of negative reactions. Because it's not really working the way that we think it should work, right?
Right.
And so I think like one of the things with the Matrix, with smartphones, one of the things is that people are surrounding themselves digitally. They're creating this sort of digital lives, right? They have Facebook constantly talking to them, or Instagram that they're flipping through when they're waiting for those intolerable intervals to go through, right? Mm-hmm. And that they're creating their own matrix, because basically everybody's rejected reality. Okay. So the fact of the matter is that like we are not like nobody that has access to technology is not creating their own matrix for themselves. Right. It's just not happening, because everything that you're using, everything that you're doing on a sort of a day-to-day basis is creating an environment around you that is more symbiotic for your wants, needs, and purposes. There's not a lot of just weathering it and just dealing, right? There is, mm-hmm. there's got to be some solution that I can think of to this problem, or maybe I can learn a solution, right? So in a lot of ways, like what people use with even just YouTube, right? YouTube is us literally downloading skills. Just takes on a much longer time frame than the Matrix shows with just hitting in a download button, right? Mm-hmm. So we can't just download directly into our brains. But like, you know, as a homeowner, as someone who has worked on his home and worked on his car and has just recently fixed an air conditioner unit, outside unit, all of this stuff I just downloaded essentially from YouTube. And granted, it took hours and hours and hours of watching videos and then having them there with me. But these are things that never could have happened before unless I went out to find like a library with all these resources. Hopefully I would find a book that was, you know, descriptive enough for the exact problem that I'm having, while at the same time being accessible enough for me to be able to personally find the information that I need out of it. Whereas, you know, with the advent of YouTube, that esoteric information comes to me. You know, this idea of Kung Fu, which at one time was a, you know, a martial art that wasn't being even taught to Westerners, you know, is now essentially just a download away. You know what I mean? And again, of course, we're, you know, it's still much longer than the movie sort of shows. But all of this is to say that, you know, we are creating our own matrices for ourselves. When you create your in-groups online, when you create your news feeds, you are creating your own matrix in a matrix in the same exact way that Neo was. You know, Neo had his hacker groups. He created his own hacking programs, which he sold, and, you know, for money, which we see. He looked up other hackers. He was a part of hacker communities. He was creating his own world far outside of the normal day-to-day life of big city dwelling people, you know? Mm-hmm. And we ourselves are doing that. You know, wherever you live, you can be up to date on information globally as if you were there. You can watch people in real time reacting to earthquakes as they move across, you know, a fault line. And you can see people reacting one by one along that timeline on Twitter, you know, even if you're nowhere near that fault line. You know, you've created this reality where you are there. You are omnipresent. You are able to bend the rules of reality. You can't break them yet, like Neo can, you know, but you can definitely bend them and do things that were not possible and would not be possible without this.
Well, I think that the movie really kind of portrays digital and virtual spaces as somehow becoming integral to daily life, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes something that's... The question about what is real is at the heart of this. And there are certain moments where I feel the film moves out of even the kind of the everyday mundanity that we experience digital spaces now and into the more surreal questioning of how do you know what you're experiencing isn't a dream, right? Like, do you know you're actually awake or is this more like the dream? And that's sort of, you know, the Xuanzi quote about like the butterfly dreaming of being a human, or is it the human dreaming of being a butterfly? And how could we know which one is more real than the other? Mm-hmm. There's these so many great moments in the film that, you know, and I think this is why it has aged so well. It places the viewer in these moments of sort of contemplative inquiry, like, what the hell is reality? What is real? How do I know what I am experiencing isn't some kind of dream? And the metaphor of the dream is being used to, you know, as a computer program or the Matrix, et cetera, that's standing in for what the dream might mean. But we don't have to be so literal about it because there are many moments of the film that are just so awesome. Just like the scene where Agent Smith and Neo are, speaking with one another when they first introduce each other after Neo's been captured. And there's just this kind of like Men in Black vibe, right? Like there's these strange authority figures in suits that are warping reality around Neo, and they delete his mouth. Like his mouth just disappears. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of like hyper surrealism that the film plays with. And then the constant questioning of like, well, how do you know you're not asleep right now? It just does that so well. And again, with such a minimalist aesthetic, like it's not kind of hitting you over the head with too much philosophy. It just asks the right amount of questions to make you doubt, to make you question if you are, if your reality is secure. And now I've heard this from just looking at the, you know, as far back as the research goes, Wikipedia page on the Matrix, but, I was reading earlier that it was actually William Gibson. You know, William Gibson used the word matrix in his cyberpunk novel, Neuromancer. But he said that he borrowed it from somebody earlier than him, and I forget that guy's name. The 1969 novel, The White Room, I think, was the first time The Matrix was used. But then he says that after seeing The Matrix, that he feels The Matrix really kind of borrows more from Philip K. Dick's sense of like reality upturning rather than William Gibson's, you know, usage of the Matrix, although Gibson uses it in a similar way as like getting plugged in and getting addicted to it and wanting to go back to it, right, to transcend mm-hmm. meat space and that kind of stuff. So he's got the Gnostic stuff too, but I get what Gibson means in that, like, I really feel the film effectively translates this question of like, what the hell is reality? Do we actually even know? And you as the reader get it, you as the viewer get infected by that question, and you start to feel that way about yourself. And I think this is where you go back to with the kind of initiation, being a teenager in the 90s, right? And then having a movie that's like, what if the reality that you're existing in right now is somehow fake? And that's right. The question, that's the Philip K. Dick like inquiry, the one that made him go crazy sometimes in real life. It's like, what if it's fake and who's faking it? What if we right. view reality that way? Well, your entire reality starts to do backflips. It starts to flip over again and again and again as you question it. And it's that surrealism that like is so effective in Philip K. Dick that is also so effective in this first movie. And you as the viewer watching this for the first time, just experiencing these like infectious questions about your own experience. Like even me watching this movie, you know, for the who know how many times I've seen this film over the years, sitting on the couch in you know, my apartment, there's like this feeling like, well, how do I know this is real? You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I just want to like speak to the strangeness of the film, the weirdness of the film, because that's not really talked about too much, but I think it's really integral to how it's so successful.
Well, and you know, I also think that there's a certain aspect of, there's certain aspect of consciousness kind of play that's happening there. I mean, the entire first half an hour of the movie is about every 5 or 10 minutes we see Neo waking up, you know? Mm-hmm. And so almost right away, they're basically going sleep, wake, sleep, wake, sleep, wake. And it's basically showing you without directly showing you, especially as if you're watching it for the first time, that there's a play kind of going on. It's basically already having you question reality. You know, when Neo gets his mouth sort of deleted and he gets infected by a probe, he immediately wakes up and grabs his stomach from a dream. And so we as the audience are not sure if this was real or not. And then it's also making us then additionally rethink back to the scene before it where Neo tries to escape his office building and gets stopped. So then, you know, we immediately are going, is this real? Did he ever get that phone call, or was that just a part of the dream beforehand, or did the dream stop once he was in custody, or what? You know, so we're already kind of playing with reality here. We have we're almost on the brink of an unreliable narrator in this way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's not an actual narrator, of course, but just this idea that you're not sure whether what you're watching actually happened or not. And then you see, you know, of course that sediment, you know, that cements into what, you know, of course that wasn't a dream. It really did happen and all these other things. But then that of course then makes you go, well, then if those parts were real, what parts were, then that means the rest of it wasn't, you know, and that's where you sort of take the red pill and go, all of your life before this moment wasn't real.
Right. You know? Yeah. And then there's these moments too, like the Alice in Wonderland mythos, right. Of like mm-hmm. going down the rabbit hole. I mean, these have become tropes again, because of The Matrix, like it renewed that cliche and that archetype of Alice in Wonderland, because you feel like you're going into this surreal space with this film. But, you know, there's just so many kind of little mythical and magical signs and symbols that make this into such a great archetypal hero's journey too. Like follow the white rabbit right at the beginning of mm-hmm. the film as he wakes up. As it's kind of lacing your user viewer experience with this question of like what's real and what's not real, it's also dropping these kind of archetypal symbols like following the white rabbit, and he goes to the club at night, right? He goes mm-hmm. he follows the White Rabbit because the girl has the White Rabbit tattoo. So it's like, okay, well, the digital world seems to be playing into the real world. Somehow this agent or character, Morpheus, is speaking to him online and seems to know what's going on in his reality. And at that point, you don't really know how the Matrix works. So you don't really know that they could probably just read the code on the computer screen and it's not that magical. But at that moment right. in the film, it is very magical, right? The bending of the spoon thing, the weird, you know, the prophecy about all this stuff. There's just so many mythological layers that help booster the feeling of supernaturalism and hyper-reality that this film so well produces. And, yeah. you know, even like I'm thinking about the moment, one of the most important moments in the film towards the end when Neo dies in the Matrix. And I know there's like Christian symbolism here. He's like digital Jesus, and literally, you know, there's Trinity, which is a Christian, you know, the Holy Trinity. So there's all these other mythical Christian metaphors as well, layered in here. There's a lot packed into this film. And yeah. when she's speaking to him and the sentinels are coming down, bearing down on the ship, and there's this moment of like, it will take a miracle, you know, to solve this or to somehow get him to like come back to life. He does, right? With love. I know, like, because she says she admits her love to him and he wakes up and he comes back to life, etc. There's that. And then there's the other moment before when Mouse almost gets killed. And yeah. then Cypher even literally says this, and kind of just a nod to the audience, I guess, where he's like, it'll take a literal miracle for any of you to survive, or for your chosen one to survive this, because I'm literally here about to pull the plug out of his head and kill him, and there's nothing here to stop me. It would literally take a miracle. Well, guess what? Mouse is still alive and he kills him. So
yeah.
So there's these moments where the narrative of this being a computer program breaks that wall and goes mm-hmm. into, okay, somehow both in the digital and the analog world, something bigger is going on. Something yeah. stranger is going on. And I like those moments in this film, and I didn't notice them really pronounced in previous views. And this time I did. So it's like, huh, there's something like bigger here, which brings you back to the question of like, what's real? The infectious question, what is playing with reality, both simulated and analog, right?
Yeah.
And again, when it's what the film does so brilliantly.
Well, and, you know, and I also think, too, that a lot of it has to do with choice and free will, and what really is choice and what really is free will, especially because, you know, in a lot of ways, the sort of the technological view on reality is that it's all basically just your wetware computer just processing signals. You know, the soul is just a conception layered over the top of that to try to understand things. The sort of strict materialist idea of input output is what your brain's doing. It's just, you know, it's doing what a computer does. It's just doing it with different hardware. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even Neo says when he's asked by the Oracle, she asks him, you know, why is it that you don't believe in fate, basically? And he's like, 'cause I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my own life, you know? And that's sort of like the overarching, I think, a theme for Neo as an individual, is him coming to terms with the things that he can't control, and this idea that there are certain inevitabilities that also happen in life and in reality and in existence. And I think that that's kind of a strong sort of theme, especially for today. Because there's a lot of people that are feeling less and less in control,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the problems of the world and the country can definitely make one feel small, especially when you're keeping up to date with what's going on at the, you know, up to the second with social media and interconnectedness. And I think that the sort of the narrative and the moral of the story in certain ways is that once you cease expecting for things to be exactly as you expect them to be, is when you can start really seeing how they are, you know, mm-hmm. And sort of the way that Neo couldn't see the Matrix until he stopped trying to look for it and just saw it, You know, yeah. I mean, Morpheus says no one can be told what the Matrix is. They have to be shown for themselves. And this idea that, like, you're not going to get it if someone just tells you. You have to have that experience. You have to go through, like you said, the initiations, you know, a ritual in a certain way. And, you know, and I think in certain ways, too, that also leads itself to a commentary on, you know, potentially maturation and even elitism to a certain extent, which is, oh, well, you can't get it unless you experience it. Right. And of course, that leads also over to areas like virtual reality, like you and I have talked about, where you really actually can't get it unless you've experienced it. Like, yes, you can get it in concept. You can get some of the scope of what it's trying to do. But if you haven't had your face in it, it's going to be like trying to tell somebody how to drive a car without letting them actually drive a car. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Well, there's something interesting about that statement. And, you know, it's a very Gnostic statement. It's saying you have to know for yourself. You have to know the truth for yourself. Nobody can tell it to you. You have to know it in this very deeply profound subjective way where it's yours, mm-hmm. and yours alone as this individual. And mm-hmm. I think that's it's very Gnostic. The truth is this personal, subjective, individual thing, and it has to be known by each individual. It can never be simply authoritatively exclaimed by anybody. It has to be known for yourself. And that's very Gnostic, very kind of radically individualistic, and also very, you know, early internet mythos culture was very libertarian. It was all about mm-hmm. that. It was all about mm-hmm. like individuals creating their own truths and insights and sovereignties and freed of, you know, the limitations of old fashioned legal authority and borders and boundaries, which is another theme that comes up in this film, that the release of all borders and boundaries. You know, the challenge of Neo is this kind of revelation, like the end of control systems. And, you know, that ties very much to this kind of self-knowledge and know thyself. But then there's this other aspect of it too, that's very mythological in that sense, where, you know, myth is not, I think as moderns, we commonly mistake what it means to believe. Like if we are a Christian today or something else, we might say, I believe in Christ, or I believe in this is how reality came to be from this particular belief system. People say, you know, religions are like belief systems or operating systems, and they have their own like code and blah, blah, blah. But really, the way you understand something in the traditional mythical sense is to undergo it. And there's no way for any person to share that initiation experience except to go through it themselves. Like mm-hmm. that's why you kept it secret. That's why the initiated did not share what they had to go through to the uninitiated. Not because it was elitist, although I think that crept in as well, of course.
Yeah.
But it was more for the fact that this is not something that you can just tell somebody. This is the kind of knowledge that has to be lived and undergone, and then it's yours. And there's just no shortcut to it. And so for me, like the second part of this is like, there's kind of a contradiction with some aspects of the film, because on the one hand, they're saying that. On the other hand, you can just download Kung Fu, you know? So right, there's like, right, well, right. you know, I don't know well, if I you mean, can but really...
Then- You know, but then Morpheus, of course, after he goes, I know Kung Fu, what does he say? Show me.
Show me, yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. So it's literally going, oh, sure, you can tell me you know Kung uh-huh. Fu, but you don't know Kung Fu till you've used your Kung Fu.
Yeah, yeah, there's some experiential lessons that he definitely has to undergo, that's for sure. But, you know, it's just sort of one of those ambiguities with digital culture where we kind of want to just figure it all out immediately, those intolerable intervals that we talk about in our first episode mm-hmm. of Technologisms. Yeah. You know, it's for those of you who haven't listened to that episode yet, it's a William James reference where he's talking about how basically intellectual, rational thinking kind of wants to get to the end point as quickly as possible, as pragmatically as possible. And the trouble with that is that it sort of discounts these messier, organic, durational experiences of time where we have to kind of like just go undergo something for a while before we really know it. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's what we're referring to here with the expediency of digital culture and downloading everything instantaneously. And then also the fact of having to be a human being and live things out. And, but I think you're right that Neo definitely has to live things out for sure.
Well, and like one of the things about the actual experience of sort of being pulled out of the Matrix is, you know, I mean, in the whole movie, there's tons of references to it. But to me, I noticed very quickly some interesting little things specifically about tubes. So like we see at the very beginning, we come out of like a telephone like receiver, I think. We're sort of traveling the informational tubes in the wires of the internet. When Neo gets pulled out, we literally follow down his esophagus. And then when he comes out of the pod, he's flushed down another tube, mm-hmm. you know? And then he has all these, of course, he has all these tubes connected to him that that disconnect both in his head, all over his body. And one of the things I was kind of interested in is this idea of why did he need so many tubes in his body, right? So I used to work in a hospital, and there's definitely plenty of tubes that come out of people that are in different, you know, ill states of health, but not as many as in the Matrix, right? And if you're not using your body in your tube, because, you know, they say, why my eyes hurt? Because you never used them before. Your muscles have atrophy because you've never used them before. This idea that why do you need so many tubes into your body all over, you know, dozens of them, maybe up and down your arms. And one of the thoughts that I had was that the tubes actually more represent all of our interconnectedness rather than actually being like a biophysical connection to the machine system somehow, you know? Like I thought of it as when the tubes are popping off of him and the machine kind of grabs him by the neck and pulls out his head connector. I was actually thinking that that's an amazing sort of look at sort of what I would call disconnect culture. You know, like people that are like, all right, I'm going on a break from all my social media and, you know, you can only reach me by this way or this way. Or even people that like just switch to just flip phones. You know, they're sort of just taking this. They're literally connecting dozens of tubes, disconnecting dozens of tubes from themselves, you know.
Yeah.
And it's things that you didn't even know were there connected to you. Just tons and tons and tons of holes and connections that are now sort of laid bare. And then, of course, we show, you know, they show Neo's body being rehabbed and all those sort of holes being, you know, in some way or another, you know, tended to and you know, assuaged in certain ways. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, I'm probably reaching here because, of course, this is all pre-digital media. But I feel like all those tubes disconnecting has a better allegory to modern day and what the Matrix is because, you know, each one of those tube sort of represents a different connection to reality, you know, not just the head connection, but this sort of total body connection from head to toe with all these little ports all over the body, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's
this, like, human IO port, basically, you know.
Yeah, I got a couple of different metaphors from that. Like, first of all, like, I really like the tubes as a I interpreted them watching the film this time as passageways, liminal spaces, moving in and out of different forms of reality, right? Like that's how it's a passageway of birth, right? It's literally like a birth womb, exiting the womb metaphor. And then it's also, you know, this like an initiative tunnel, right? He's literally disconnecting from the Matrix. You go down, you follow down his throat as it's becoming metallic and it gets converted into that creepy metallic voice. So there's this kind of liminality that the tube represents of moving from one reality to another. And it's always kind of used in that way, waking and dreaming. When he wakes up sometimes, like at the beginning of the film, it uses the tubes of the internet, the tubes.
Mm-hmm. The series of tubes. Yeah.
Just a series of tubes. So there's like that metaphor of like passageways, birth, liminality, like moving from one reality to back to another reality. And then there's the, like you're saying, there's a connectivity. And even like the Matrix as a metaphor for the ambiguity of being embedded in something, right? Like being enmeshed in a matrix, you get the idea that there's like intersecting and overlapping lines of connection that bind you to a reality. And like for me, like similar to what you're saying, like the tubes that Neo has to have ripped out of him and then healed and disconnected from are his severing from that form of reality. You know, he's been enmeshed in it for so long. Of course, he's going to be almost like grown into it you know, like a vine.
Yeah.
And so he's got to learn, got to kind of grow out of that phase. So there's a kind of an image of becoming an individual, moving out of this matrix of collectivity, of being, you know, unaware, not being awake yet to reality, right? Of being kind of in Plato's cave, in the matrix, in the enmeshment, not aware of yourself as an individual yet, and not a, not capable of discovering reality as it is, right? The desert of the real. So there's a lot of metaphors of like you're saying, disconnecting from the matrix, individuality, kind of growing up in consciousness, you know? And I think this is why Wilbur liked it a lot too. It was that sort of sense of, you know, this is how the evolution of consciousness works. We move from the sort of embedded matrix into autonomy and the birth of the ego and individuation, et cetera. So I see a lot of those in the film. And I think those meshworks and wires and are good images as well that like maybe aren't necessarily appreciated as much as they should be, because that's really the kind of symbol of what it means to be embedded in something. It's like literally there's tendrils of connection that are just all over you, and you're embedded in this in like a fully embodied way. And that makes it a much more difficult task. You're not just going to get woke. You have to like literally like sever those connections too. And there's this desire to go back in. Like Cypher is an interesting character. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like being woke. He doesn't want to be in the desert of the real. He wants to go back and enjoy the virtual steak and be rich and just sort of enjoy the fakeness of reality and forget he ever woke up. So he wants to forget.
When we see that same sort of struggle happen very briefly with Neo as well, when they're driving to, I believe, go see the Oracle for the first time, he sees a Chinese food shop, and he's like, "Oh, I used to eat that place all the time. Really good noodles." And then he just looks like really depressed, and then he's like, "I have all these memories of my life, but I guess they never happened, you know." And then Trinity says something along the lines of, "No, it just means that, you know, the Matrix can't tell you who you are, you know." In other words, these sort of life experiences are not the totality of who you are as an individual. You know, you are greater than just the sum of your experiences, you know, sort of trying to remind him to get out of that sort of strictly materialist kind of view, you know?
Yeah.
Because of course, Morpheus doesn't hold a strictly materialist view, because he believes in the One, he believes in the prophecy, he believes in oracles, right? So he's very much not a materialist. He's not just like everything that comes out of your brain is just a computer, even though literally everything that comes out of your brain was just a computer. So, you know,
I mean, there's like a lot of, the film is working with a lot of philosophical ideas about cognition, perception, and what consciousness is that go back in Western philosophy for a while. Like, I know they probably were influenced by, I think even the wiki page said this, that they were influenced by like Immanuel Kant. And Kant has a sort of interesting idea about like knowing things, just to sum up. Like, a lot of philosophers have this, even Descartes as well, like the sense that, our brain is basically processing our senses and then creating an image of the world. But how do we really know what's out there? We don't. There's this like subject and object dichotomy where we don't actually know that anything is real or substantial, or if there are even other people, because we're just kind of enmeshed in our own little micro matrix that is our brains, that is our minds, that interprets all of the senses and produces an experience of reality for us. But we don't really know what's out there, right? Like, it's a very common phrase a lot of Western philosophers have, that like, we don't ever know a thing in itself. We can never know what it is. We can only have our sense impressions of it. And this is sort of like Kantian distinction, which goes back to Descartes. And Descartes has these meditations that are straight out of the matrix. And I kind of wonder if they made them read this too. He has these sort of like semi-paranoid meditation on the possibility that he's a brain in a vat, essentially, and that there could be some evil spirit that's basically, or demon that is, or devil that is creating reality around him, and he'll never know because he's just a little brain in a vat. He's just like a little mind disconnected from anything, and he doesn't really know if anyone else is out there. And I felt kind of bad reading that for Descartes. I was like, oh gosh. But this, because of the distinctions and dichotomies that have built up in Western philosophy in the history of like Western consciousness and about cognition, it sets us up for asking these kinds of questions. Like, how do we know what's real? And I think this film really, I'm sure this is used in a lot of philosophy classes because of how well it articulates these deep philosophical problems that keep philosophers up at night. And right, it does that very well. And as at the same time, as you're saying, like, there's a non-materialist element of this too, because ultimately the film is not saying that we're just brains in vats. It's saying that, like, human meaning somehow transcends the digital and the analog. And there's these moments of intervention, of strange providence, that break reality, that sort of break the desert of the real and interrupt it. And that is also a very Christian theme, in, I'm going to say, in a very sci-fi way. In a Philip K. Dickian sense, it's a very Christian theme, because, like, Phil Dick also had this theory, or kind of like a working metaphysics in a lot of his writing, that the world is somehow not the full reality. We're kind of sold into this world. It's kind of fake and it's kind of falling apart, but there's this greater reality that's always trying to break into it and rescue it somehow or redeem it somehow. And he you know, he was kind of like a weird, he was a weird Christian. Let's just put it that way. And this movie is a weird Christianity in that way. It's a kind of a Gnostic Christianity. So I really like this about the film as well, and that it how it flips and modernizes this Gnostic Christian mythos about, like, reality being fake, but then don't worry, Jesus as Neo is coming in and he's breaking things down and he's pulling away all the illusions, so everybody wakes up. And what does waking up really mean? It's not just being woke to the reality being fake. It's also kind of waking up to this greater sense of self that can emerge, this sort of Gnostic self, which is how the film ends. He just, like, literally, like, hangs up the phone saying, like, it's it, like, this reality's over, and how you respond to that is up to you. And I think he's talking both to us and to the systems of control and authority. And then he just, like, flies away in the middle of the city.
And I mean, like, you know, for who Neo is by the end of the movie, you know, he's very much the traditional hero, you know, having really sort of accepted and come to terms with things and sort of fulfilled their destiny in a certain way. But I also think that a lot of times, a lot of parts of this movie, I mean, so one of the great things is we don't really know that Neo is the one until pretty close to the end of the entire movie.
Yeah.
Right. So we have Neo go to the Oracle, and the Oracle's never wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And the Oracle looks at him, looks him over, and then tells him, sorry, kid, you're not the one, you know? And so, you know, of course, obviously, since we're watching a main character in a movie, and if you have enough meta understanding of storytelling, that you know that this is going to go somewhere else. But from a purely sort of present moment viewer experience, we don't know that Neo's the one till basically the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. The thing is that Neo, and of course Neo himself doesn't know that he's the one. I mean, we see things like when Mouse says, "Oh, take a look at his neurokinetics when he's fighting Morpheus. It's way above normal," is what he says, right?
Yeah.
But then we see him do the jump program, and everyone's like, everyone falls the first time. Neo falls, and so everyone's like, oh, well, maybe his neurokinetics are above normal, but his ability to do the jump program isn't, so I guess he's maybe not the one, right? So that's putting doubt in our minds, the viewer's mind, right? So we don't know that he's the one. And then we see the Oracle, and the Oracle tells him he's not the one. You know, so we have this sort of progression where we're being told that really that him being the one is based on, at this point, Morpheus's faith, which of course they explore more in the sequels. But it's sort of just lightly touched upon that this is sort of a faith thing. You know, even Neo, when he's in the agent training program, he goes, "What are you trying to tell me? That I can dodge bullets?" And he says it in a way that's like pretty like, He's asking it like he's just being silly, almost like seriously, are you trying to feed me this crap, right? And then Morpheus smiles and then says, "When you know, I'm telling you that you won't have to, you know, when you're ready, you won't even have to dodge the bullets." So it's this sort of interesting thing where Morpheus is sort of one-upping Neo's self-doubt. You know, Morpheus has full confidence that Neo's the one, and that dodging bullets is the least of the things that he can do.
Yeah,
you know. But we as the viewer, we don't know this, right? And in fact, we're told specifically he's not. So for watching Neo as a character, we see Morpheus get captured. And then what does Neo do? Neo decides to run in and go and rescue Morpheus. And he doesn't do that because he thinks he's the one. He does that specifically because the Oracle told him he's not the one. And that because he's not the one, he kind of has a duty to Morpheus to not let Morpheus give his life for him because he's not the one. Right. So it's sort of like it's very kind of cyclical in that sort of logical progression there. Like he's doing it, but that's the real hero thing to do. But he's actually doing it because he was told that he's not the hero, you know, in that sort of way. So I really liked kind of that play on him choosing things. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the movie, so many times people talk about choice, like choice, free will. Determinism is like where so much of the actual back and forth on screen drama is coming from. I mean, his boss even tells him when he gets in trouble for being late to work, he tells him either you choose to be here at your desk on time every day or you choose to find another job. And just a few minutes before that, he says, Neo, Mr. Anderson, I think is what he calls him. He says to him, you're the kind of person that thinks that the rules don't apply to you, that you can just do whatever you want, you know. And it's kind of interesting, you know, looking back at the film now, that sort of early moment where the boss is chastising him is actually sort of the Matrix almost telling him that it's up to him. You know, it's the Matrix in a way sort of telling him, like, your choice matters. Mm-hmm. You are breaking and bending rules already, even though you're not jacked out, you know, of the Matrix. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little sort of, I don't know, foreshadowing, I guess you could call it in that way. But I really like this play of choice, right? So you know, if Neo goes... You know, if Neo doesn't choose to go get Morpheus, is he still the one? Or was his choice to go get Morpheus the one, right? So if Morpheus dies after giving the access codes to the Zion mainframe, what's Neo's story look like? Like, he doesn't die right away, mm-hmm. right? Like, does Neo still become the one when he gets to Zion? You know?
Yeah.
Or is he only the one because he's made those choices and he went out of his way to do those things and then that let him sort of free his mind, right? So I thought that was really quite interesting. I liked that sort of play on choice and free will versus determinism and how that sort of plays out. And even towards the end, you hear, you know, I believe it's Morpheus's very last line, and he says he's starting to believe, right? We don't see Neo going, I'm the one, right? We don't see Neo saying, like, oh, look at all these things that I can do, right?
Right.
It's just that he's beginning to believe in his ability, right?
Well, that's...
And
yeah.
I feel like that kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the actual experience
exactly.
of the ritual.
Exactly. Yeah, I was about to just chime in and say that, you know, it seems that his capacity to be the chosen one is based on his ability to know reality in a certain way, right? Like to know it for himself. Like, as you mm-hmm. mentioned before, like you won't need to dodge the bullets.
Right.
In the initial martial arts hand-to-hand lesson where they're fighting for the first time in the dojo, he's teaching him, like, he asks him, like, is that really air you're breathing? You know, there's these like mm-hmm. moments of pointing out instruction where he's trying to get Neo to realize this at a fundamental subjective interior. I don't know how to exactly explain it aside from like a kind of a gnosis of himself. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know what I am, but I know what I must do. And I know what I can do. Right. And it's like until he could make that stand in that way, in that kind of knowing way, he didn't go in believing he was the one. But he did go in believing, like, well, I can bend the system, or I need to do this because it's the right thing. It's his choices, his ethics, and his, like, his actual, like, actions mm-hmm. through his own will and through his own knowledge and self-knowledge about what he believes, what he's come to understand, that actually is what it means to be the one. And not being told that he's the one, but actually kind of acting out in a certain particular way that he ends up doing. What I find interesting too is that the Oracle, she mentions to him, I wrote down the line, I don't have it in front of me, but to paraphrase her, when he asks her about, you know, the prophecy, she says, sorry, kid, you got the gift, but you're still figuring things out, maybe in the next life. Mm-hmm. And technically speaking, she didn't say he wasn't the one. She said, you have the gift, which is an interesting way to respond. Yeah. But you're still working things out or something to that degree. And then she says, maybe in the next life. And he does die before he really becomes himself. So yep. she never really lied to him, but she said exactly what he needed to hear, just like Morpheus was saying. Like, I thought that was really clever in terms of the screenwriting of how they did that, how they phrased it, so that she wasn't going to contradict the prophecy at the same time as sending Neo off into, you know, basically grokking that, like, oh, maybe I'm not the one. She basically said I wasn't. And he ended up kind of playing it out exactly how she said it. He got the gift.
Yeah.
He has the gift. He does have the ability. He has the ability to be the one, but maybe in the next life. And he literally does have to die before he actualizes those capacities in himself. So that was really clever. I really loved that. That was such a little Easter egg.
That's an amazing little moment of that sort of, there's no fat on that.
Nope.
Right?
It's so eloquent. It was just like so succinct and so poetic and explains everything, but it doesn't hit you over the head with it at all. It's so subtle.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you wouldn't like, it feels like a throwaway line, like, sorry, kid, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
But then when you're really looking at what she actually said and how that actually fits in the movie, you're like, wow, that's like, she's literally saying what literally is about to happen.
Yep.
You know? And that was absolutely like just pretty much one of the most brilliant little Easter egg kind of moments I noticed in the movie, definitely this time as well. It's great that you sort of wrote that down, or, you know, you remembered to bring that part up, because I noticed that almost right away, because I was, you know, in the first 30 minutes, I was like, man, there's not a single line I wouldn't keep in this. Like, everybody's saying exactly what they need to develop their characters, to explain the next scene, to set up everything that's about to happen. Because, like, I was thinking, like, how crazy and how much stuff they have to cover to make this whole Matrix idea make any sense to an audience. Like, it's really pretty difficult. Like, they've got this whole machine war thing that you don't even know about until after you're in the, you know, jacked out of the Matrix. I mean, you really don't know anything about the machines until you see one grab Neo by the neck, you know?
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you're like, wait, what the hell? And there's all these, you know, the fields of human bodies jacked into the system, you know, like, what the hell am I even looking at? You know? Yeah. Like, that's just, it's just insanity. Like, but they had to sort of put together this whole, you know, this whole mythos and slowly unravel it through this one character's experience. And then, you know, the characters around him, to make all of this make sense. And somehow they do it in like a not very long movie. Like, the movie is not that long, you know, like, it's not like it's 2.5 hour movie, you know?
Right. Right. It really isn't that long, and it goes by so fast. That's what I noticed too, watching it this time around. It just went by in a flash. And again, because of it was so tightly written, the screenplay was so good that there was no extraneous sequences like you get in the later films, where it's just like, what is going on? What is all this philosophizing doing in the middle of the film? Like, and I like philosophizing in films, but in those, it just felt like it wasn't part of the story exactly. Or it was in an abstract way, but this one, no, everything was really lean. And again, like, I think the film relied so much on the story to philosophize rather than needing to kind of pause and then talk about what the story is actually doing at a kind of a meta level, like the other films do. This one, it weaves the philosophy right into the narrative, into the hero's journey, into the waking up. I mean, and that's why, like, you and I were watching the film or talking about the film a few weeks ago, and I think we stayed up to like 2:30 just like chatting about it.
Yeah,
like three did. Or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think because we were talking about how great the first film was and how, like, even though we really enjoyed it, the other two, they just weren't the same thing as the first film. Like, it almost doesn't need any other films. It's such a gospel of the Matrix individual book in itself that it doesn't need any more of the story. And how can it really? Because by the end of the film, all things considered, Keanu as Neo is the one. He's Jesus. And Jesus is saying, like, your reality is over. It's time for you to get the truth. It's time for you to wake up. And the film credits roll as he flies away like Superman. And Raging as the Machine is playing, and it's like,
and
you
their
can't
song
really
Wake
follow
Up
up
is the song
that.
That's playing.
Yeah, you can't really follow up on that.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the biggest problem is literally just having him fly away. I think like from a writing standpoint, like you basically just wrote Superman, and like Superman's, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I kind of consider him to be like one of the most boring superheroes ever, because he only has like one thing that can stop him, and his stories just really aren't that interesting as an individual, because he just doesn't really do anything that interesting, you know?
Yeah.
So here we have, you know, Neo, he's now jacked out. You can't re-jack out, right? Like once you're out of the Matrix, and once you know what the Matrix is, you can't unknow that. Right. So I think that's kind of one of the reasons why I think The Matrix worked better as a single film. But I will say that I love both of the other two films. I just consider them to be sequels to each other rather than a sequel to The Matrix. I actually consider that the closest actual sequel to The Matrix that we got was The Animatrix.
I felt like
all of those little vignettes told you more about what the thing that the first movie did than the other two movies did, you know? So I kind of think of the other two movies as almost like the 10 years later remake, of The Matrix, where they decided to delve deeper on, like, I feel like you would hear it as like, okay, well, you know, we were approached by some executives that just couldn't stop talking about Zion. We had mentioned Zion so much in the first movie, and we just really need to make sure that we saw Zion and really understood the people from Zion.
Yeah, you know, let's do like a Zion miniseries. Let's go into the politics of Zion and have a big grand finale with a big war.
Yeah, that's what I think of the Matrix sequels as.
Yeah.
But I personally, the thing that I loved, for me a lot, was the thing about the second movie. So here's the thing is these movies hit at an age that was just like perfect for us. But like the second movie I loved because as a teenager, it didn't shy away from dealing with weird sex, if that makes sense, or just weird sexuality. So as a confused or strange, you know, teenager moving into the strange world of your own body and everything, that movie was basically just like, hey, realize that, you know, we didn't talk about how sex plays into the Matrix, you know, like what the real experience of this is. And in that way, I really liked actually some aspects of the second movie that a lot of people hated, where they were like, what is this? It's like, it's unnecessarily sexy and sort of, just over the top, you know, with like the big, like BDSM bar that, you know, the Merovingian is in and all this other stuff. And the whole thing about with this cake, his special cake, and, you know, he has a lover and all this other stuff. But like, I liked that because I was like, hey, these guys are actually trying to talk about something else, because, you know, death and sex are like the two things that are like some of the most innate integral part of human experience.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So understanding death and sex is something that very much is a topic of conversation and should be discussed. So of course it didn't do it in like the best ways at all possible. But as a teenager, I just loved it. I thought it was great. I thought that, you know, they could have done better in a lot of places, but I thought that worked for me. I thought that the highway chase scene was amazing. The final movie with the big mech battle in Zion, I freaking loved that, because, you know, who doesn't love mechs? And I loved the idea because they had a young guy there who, you know, got into the mech and he was too young to join the military corps there. And he was allowed to, you know, sort of jump in and do that, you know?
Yeah.
I liked a lot of those aspects, but that's because I'm definitely like, I'm just telling, like, sort of like as a disclaimer, total rose tinted glasses. I'll just never be able to separate my teenage viewings of that thing with the thing that it is.
Oh, of course.
So, you know, beyond that, it's just like, I completely agree with everybody that says that they're trash and for all the reasons that they're trash, but I still love it anyway.
I totally understand. And I have other films that I feel the same way about. And even these, like I saw it in theaters with my friends at the time, you know, and these, the Matrix trilogy, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and then the Star Wars prequels, well, they're all kind of like overlapping with one another at the same time. And it was sort of this feeling that, oh, we're in our own kind of golden age of massive Hollywood movies, and these are our epic stories of the time. And I don't think many people had a lot of critical lenses on these films at the time. And Lord of the Rings, I think, is aged the best out of all those ones that I've mentioned. By far. But, you know, I think these two films, they're iterative, they're interesting in their own right as like little micro stories. I mean, it's almost like fan fiction that's well written. It's like, oh, I as a writer want to explore the lives of the people in Zion and the fate of the city. And that could be its own little story that could be well written and have good character development and explore things like you're talking about, like the sexuality element and the last stand of Zion in the last film. It was a good action sequence with lots of CG. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine on its own. You know, it's just a different kind of creature than the first film, which by its own nature was the film as a structure is like pulling you out of your embeddedness in the Matrix, making you think about like what's real, and then pulling mm-hmm. you out of it into this desert of the real, this hyper futuristic reality with giant bug AI and horrible like mm-hmm. humans in tubes as battery powering this like scary alien insectoid AI civilization. Like, it's like kind of waking up to this nightmarish future that you only get in glimpses. And so it retains a kind of an ambiguous power. Whereas if mm-hmm. like you explain it all away and like you kind of go into what Zion is all about, and then like you talk about the machines and how to beat them, like it loses that feeling of the other world of what if we're actually in the future right now and we're just being dominated by this strange insectoid bug AI race, you know, in a decimated planet. Yeah. Like, if you leave it there, I think the ambiguity of those ideas and the images that are in the first film are enough. They're like, they're powerful enough for you to kind of go, whoa, what if reality isn't what it seems? And I'm looking through the looking glass, I'm going down the rabbit hole, and there's something strange on the other side. Once you get to the other side, it becomes kind of like, all right, like BDSM and Zion, cool. Like, it just, it loses yeah. it's not the same anymore. And that's fine. Right. But, you know, which is why I guess I'm saying, like, I think it's right for you to kind of feel like there's the Matrix, and then there's these two other stories that are iterative, and they kind of feed off, they're sequels of each other, but they're just different things or different creatures than the first film, which is totally, it's like Morpheus says, you have to just experience it. It's something you just have to go through, and it makes you think about reality and the senses and waking and dreaming in such a fundamental way and in such a sparse minimalist way in terms of the screenwriting, while using action, you know, and like kung fu and awesome technical effects, that like it stands alone and it achieves what it needs to achieve on its own. And in that sense, I think it's a masterpiece the Wachowskis achieved.
Absolutely.
The other films, not so much, but it's fine because they're fun and weird and, you know, whatever.
They're doing their own thing and they're happy to do it.
Yeah, they're happy to do it. Like. And we could be happy and enjoy them doing their own thing, you know, as long as we're not expecting it to be, you know, a true sequel to The Matrix.
And I don't think you're going to have that ever again. Like I don't think someone could take an experimental, relatively new directorial pair and give them literally just a giant conduit for philosophy and technology conversations with a veneer of gunplay action and kung fu.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't think that you could do that.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's like the other element of this film that we didn't really dive into, but like, just like cinema history wise, like how much the film changed so much of like Hollywood, like the technical like effects and the choreography
like fundamentally was different from then on.
Like, I don't think people had done wushu in American films before that. The choreography and then also the cinematography with the like the 3D panning around like Trinity at the beginning of the film. And just like all of those technical effects with the camera work, like everybody copied, like everybody. There were so many copycat movies after The Matrix. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
So it changed cinema history on top of making cinema history as one of the most important films, I think, of the end of the 20th century, you know? So, yeah, I love it. And I get why like the integral theorist people love it. Because it has to do with matrices and waking up and levels of reality and that kind of stuff. But, you know, talking about it with you here, though, it just really makes you realize like how the minimalism of the first film doesn't really need any of that extra stuff to achieve what it does. It's almost a kind of a magical realist film that it takes our world and the myths and the images of our world and flips them over and makes you question what's real and twists it and bends it and hacks it. And I think just like staying in our world and hacking it and bending it is actually more of a profound thing to do than like leaping into the fantastical other world and telling mm-hmm. stories in there. You know, it's like it has more of an effect on the viewer by like, by the end of the film, and like a good Philip K. Dick book, like when you and I watched it, like I mean, it doesn't matter what metaphor you're using, butterfly and a human being dreaming, mm-hmm. or being in a computer simulation. Like, I'm not as attached to the simulation theory. I don't know about you. Like, it's to me, it's like, okay, so we're all living in a computer, but like, nah, reality is stranger than even that. Like, you could call it whatever you want, whatever mechanism you want to call it, I don't think will really in the end stand. It's like,
no,
it's just the idea that like reality isn't what it appears, that there can be breaks in reality, and that, you know, of course the archetypal aspect is like somebody might be ensnaring you or faking the reality, et cetera, the Gnostic stuff, sure. But just the feeling that like things are not the way they appear to be is such a sublime pull, I think, for us mm-hmm. as human beings with an attention and draw to the numinous, that like we could have used any other metaphor. We're using the computer because we're in a computer age, right? But like, mm-hmm. I think the idea of Plato's cave and the idea that reality is not what it appears to be is so much more universal. And it doesn't need a computer metaphor to make the same point. And so I think it stands in even stronger than that. And I know some of my listeners simulation theory and stuff, but I don't know. I just never really found the fact that because we're calling it a computer and have a metaphor for technology in our age, that it's somehow more believable or less, you know?
Right, right.
So
no, yeah, I'm with you in the same way. I think that for me, it's like simulation theory one way or another doesn't really matter to me. But, you know, maybe that's just because we've seen The Matrix, and it was like we took to heart the whole thing where he's like, all these memories of things, they didn't happen, you know? And then, you know, like I was just saying, Trinity's statement, well, no, it just means that The Matrix can't tell you who you are.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way, I think maybe you and I have just very early on, maybe we just understood that, like, whether it's a simulation or not, it doesn't tell us who we are. It doesn't tell us the whole picture. There's plenty of other strangeness that isn't sort of comprised in that.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah. I think this is a good moment to pause because we go about 90 minutes typically on mutations. But I hope listeners enjoyed this conversation. And if you like this, you got a taste of what we'll be doing over at Technologisms. So go check out the link in the show notes here. And if you're already here listening to this on Technologisms, thank you. There'll be more shows ahead. And that's where you can find us. And thanks for being on the show, Nick.
Thanks for having me. And for those who are listening, if you ever watched the original Matrix trilogy, Matrix, and then Reloaded, and then Revolutions, and you didn't watch the Animatrix, please, please, please do yourself a favor and just go ahead and watch it, preferably after you watch the first movie, because it's sort of, I feel like the Animatrix did the expounding upon what the Matrix left sort of open in the best way possible that the two feature films didn't really get the ability to do. So the Animatrix, if you don't know about it, I think it's like 7 or 8 little mm-hmm. vignettes, all created in different art styles, different anime art styles. Some of them are done with computer CGI entirely. And they all tell little, like 5-10 minute little stories about sort of surrounding the Matrix, how it works, and sort of how it came to be as well. So if you haven't checked it out, definitely do yourself a favor. Watch the first movie, and then immediately afterwards, go take a quick break, and then immediately afterwards, go watch the Animatrix, because it is a treat that allows you to just sort of live in the world that the first movie created without you having to sort of deal with maybe potential frustrations that the sequel movies gave you.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that as well. you know, I was mentioning this to my wife, Natalie, just about that too. Like the Animatrix really feels like a true sequel to the first film, in that like it's expounding on the world without creating this super baroque singular plot that you have to follow. It's just like, you know, Neo's out there somewhere. He's already like transcended the capacity to write him as a character in a hero's journey, because he's now like Superman or God or Jesus, and he might show up, and he does show up a little bit, I think, in some of the stories, but it's more about everyone else now. And I feel like that was such a powerful way of doing it. Just like, it could be you, Neo could show up in your life. He becomes, that's what's great about the first film. And then this movie, these mini series, Neo becomes like Superman or like a god, I guess. You know, he might show up in your life. He becomes a sort of archetype, like a lot of superheroes do. They kind of stand in for the gods in our time. And so Neo becomes this figure who might show up and help wake you up, you know? So I just love that about those films. And they're so creatively done and poetically done too. There's a lot of great little poetic ones that retain that similar feeling of like the surrealness of reality, the questioning of what's real, and it kind of keeps hitting that note in very interesting ways. And again, without needing to follow a singular, complicated, convoluted plot. So, second that totally. So yeah,
awesome.
Hope you enjoy this. And this is the kind of conversation that you should expect over at Technologism. So Nick and I have been doing this for like 2/3 of our lives. So
we do this regularly. Yeah.
So tune in with us. We're going to just keep doing this as we have always done over at Technologisms. And occasionally I'll have you back on the show, Nick, to talk about something with the Mutations audience. So thanks again.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
All right.